From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, a little make-believe.
Everyone who grows up inculcated in a racist and sexist genre is going to have to work against that actively and consciously.
We kick off our new series on diversity in geekdom with a look at sci-fi and fantasy. But pretending isn't always a positive thing.
So earlier this year, my father decided that he was going to apply for citizenship. They took advantage of him. They filled out his paperwork poorly. They charged him $125.
How some take advantage of people trying to become U.S. citizens. Plus, one politician changes his name to Cesar Chavez to increase his Latino cred. And the discovery of mass graves of migrants in Texas. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today we're focused on pretending. For many of us, that can mean escape. Now, one way we can do that is through entertainment, particularly in works of fantasy or science fiction, which take us to alternate worlds, fictional pasts, or dystopian futures. But if you look at the way these genres are represented in the mainstream, you might think that sci-fi and fantasy authors and fans are almost all exclusively white men. In the first of a four-part series, producer Daisy Rosario takes us into the world of geekdom to look at diversity and the fight for representation.
Chances are you've seen The Lord of the Rings. Every child you've met in the last 10 years has likely read Harry Potter, and whether you're a fan or not, you can probably answer some basic questions about both Star Wars and Star Trek. But you might not know what's happening in that world right now. So I asked someone right in the thick of it, what's going on? Here's Nora Jemison.
Science fiction and fantasy are going through the same changes that the rest of the American mediascape and political landscape are going through. There is the sudden awareness that one particular kind of voice, that of straight white men, has dominated discussion and creation and publication and so on. A sort of sea change has been happening all along, but we're reaching critical mass.
That change is largely thanks to social media, but the internet didn't introduce Nora to these genres. You could also call her the award-winning author N.K. Jemisin. She's been into this stuff since she was a kid.
Science fiction stories are the power fantasies of the geek. You know, and I think that was what I was getting out of it was, you know, I kind of felt like the kid who was ostracized for being the one that liked to read. And yet in these other stories, people who liked to read and had no interest in sports could be the hero. And I think I needed that.
Eventually, she found direct inspiration.
But it was really, again, seeing Octavia Butler's books that told me I can do this in science fiction and fantasy. Because up to that point, I had seen only Black writers publishing Black books.
Nora went from writing as a hobby to entertaining the possibility of being a professional writer.
First, I was writing bog-standard science fiction and fantasy featuring stalwart white men going forth and doing stalwart white guy things. It was really only about in my mid-20s I started realizing there's something wrong with that. And I started to suddenly question, what's going on? Why is it that I have such trouble having fun in color?
Despite being a woman of color, she struggled to write characters that looked like her.
Everyone who grows up inculcated in a racist and sexist genre is going to have to work against that actively and consciously. And it's going to feel wrong at first because that's not what we're used to.
When Nora started trying to get published, she got a certain kind of feedback.
Yeah. Not sure how to relate to this. Not sure who the audience for this would be.
I love this writing and I love the story. I just don't really identify with the character. My name is Daniel Jose Older. I'm a writer, an editor, and a composer. The code in that language is saying, oh, your people don't read. The truth is, we read. We read a lot. We love science fiction. We love fantasy. And we love to read.
If the industry doesn't see Latinos and other people of color as readers, maybe it's because it already has a hard time seeing them as people. Take, for example, something that often happens to Nalo Hopkinson. She's an award-winning science fiction and fantasy writer, born in the Caribbean.
When I write in Caribbean English, very often the editor wants to correct it. And not to standard English, but to their understanding of Black American English. But they don't have a sense that Black people speak differently in different parts of, you know, America, much less different parts of the world.
And if you agree with Nora Jemison, the fact that the gatekeepers of the media don't know the difference does have an effect on what the general population understands.
We get our sense of empathy from media, from literature. We see and are encouraged to empathize with certain kinds of characters. And we are encouraged to know what they're feeling and guess at what's going on inside their heads.
Daniel Jose Older again.
We have to have this conversation about what does it do to the psyche of a culture, you know, of an entire people, both for folks of color looking at that and, you know, seeing that they can't be, we can't be our own saviors. And then to white people seeing that their role again and again is to save the world.
Hopkinson sees what it does to young people. She's a creative writing professor at the University of California, Riverside, and still has family and friends in the Caribbean.
We have a family friend who's also a professor who's been teaching for quite some time. And she says she'll get students. She's in Trinidad in the Caribbean. She'll get students who want to write science fiction, fantasy, who don't set it anywhere. They feel that they cannot use the places they know. And it breaks my heart that people feel like they have no place.
That message comes from every direction, even critically acclaimed shows. Here's Daniel.
Yeah, I love Game of Thrones, but when we see the Khaleesi be the savior, the white savior character, that is an old trope, that is a cliche. We're tired of that. It's boring.
When these authors, and also fans, try to address the issue, they get pushback. But for Daniel, Nora, and Nalo, it's not just about getting people to see their faces. It's about recognizing which faces are always there.
We're trying to get people to tell more in-depth stories, create more real, authentic characters, and do it right, and do it respectfully. We're asking people to recognize the full humanity of people of color.
And also to get people to see that it's not just about good intentions.
The other thing I encounter is people saying, well, why are you so focused on what race these writers are? I read everything. I don't pay attention to the race of the writer, so I must not be racist. All right, for game, just for now, look at your shelves. Find out the races of the writers on those shelves. I bet you most of them will be white. That's not because you're deliberately selecting for them. You don't have to.
All three agreed that if it were up to them, they would just be writers. But it's not that simple.
I don't see how I could not engage it to some extent, because I feel like if I didn't, there would be no place for me. I mean, Black, female, queer, disabled, increasingly middle-aged. I've been needing to make space for me and mine from the beginning.
Which makes sense for writers in this genre.
The weird thing about science fiction fantasy is that, in a way, it's already dealing with these issues. It is a literature that is about fighting back against state control, meeting the other, and what happens at that meeting.
Both writers and readers are working together to be heard.
There's a lot of crossover between social justice and sci-fi. And it's going to be more and more because of places like Twitter, because we're having these conversations and we're coming closer together and our voices are becoming unified in a way that they never had before.
But that doesn't mean that the fandom itself is new.
We've been here all along. We never were not here. It's just finally being acknowledged.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
I grew up eating tacos. Soft tacos from street vendors in Mexico City, tacos dorados made by my mom, tacos de pescado, tacos al pastor. Now, from breakfast to drive-through fast food, there are all types of tacos. Now, Window Rock, California is the capital of the Navajo Nation, and locals there have been eating something called a Navajo taco for over 100 years. Ann Hoffman now on the mysterious origins of the Navajo taco.
It's a hot day in northern Arizona. Summer campers Morgan Miller and James Cobb stand in a kitchen with plywood paneling and photographs of a Navajo family.
Fried bread leaves flour all over your hands.
It's not pleasant at all.
It's very pleasant. It makes you feel like you're more involved in the process.
Irene Nota is a Navajo culture teacher who's invited these campers over to her farm today in the hopes of passing on her tribe's traditions. She moves the dough outside and heats a large pan of grease over a flame.
And our grease should be really, really hot. Or maybe 400, I don't know.
As Nota puts the prepared dough into the hot grease, summer storm winds pick up.
Ooh, oh my, oh my. Hold the stony, guys.
In spite of the fierce weather, Nota continues with her lesson.
And we call it the... Datnilraj is a Navajo word for fried bread. And Apache, they call it bankahe. So that's bankahe. Bankahe, yeah. That's Apache.
The Navajo didn't always eat fry bread. Historically, they probably ate something closer to a Mexican corn tortilla and topped it with spicy lamb. But 150 years ago, the U.S. government forced the tribe to move from their homeland in Arizona to eastern New Mexico. With their cheap, government-issued rations, white flour, sugar, and lard, the Navajo people came up with fry bread. They topped the bread with ground meat, and the Navajo taco was born. But it's not clear how the dish got its name. Gustavo Arellano is the author of a book called Taco USA.
Food histories turn into food mythologies or food legends. And as a result, reporters and historians, when they try to get into actual details about a particular foodstuff or a restaurant, a lot of it's very hazy.
In my search to understand the Navajo taco, I do hear one possible explanation for the food's name. According to a tribal elder, white tourists sampled the dish in the early 20th century and christened it a Navajo taco. Arellano isn't surprised that Anglo tourists could have given Navajo food a Mexican name.
It's from the moment Americans have known about Mexican food, they've wanted it. They've wanted it and they've sought it out and they've assimilated it. And they're always asking for what's the next big trend. And this, it's a cycle, really, that goes around every decade. And you could date these cycles back to the 1880s.
The rainstorm has just ended and everyone's starving. No one's really thinking about the origins of Navajo tacos, just the fact that soon we'll be eating them. Friends and relatives of the Nota stop by for what turns out to be a lot like a family barbecue.
This is my sister-in-law, Anna Sanderson. She lives over the hill, and I invite her to come over.
While the bread fries, the campers wait anxiously for that first bite.
So you ever had fried bread?
No, never. I'm excited to try it, though.
What do you think it's going to taste like?
Maybe kind of like fried dough, but like at the fair, but with less sugar.
When it's finally time to eat, the kids clean their plates. Some say they're a little disappointed that these tacos aren't as spicy as the ones they're used to back home. But almost all go back for second helpings of fry bread, this time with honey on top. For Latino USA, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Coming up on Latino USA...
He's really politically savvy in terms of knowing that if he changed his name, it would really at least help him more than his previous name did.
A politician changes his name to Cesar Chavez with less than stellar results. Stay with us. No se vayan.
El tatuaje que tú no creías cuando yo te di.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, pretending. Those expecting congressional action on immigration reform this season may find themselves feeling, well, a little jerked around, as if the Congress were pretending to get something done, but not. So here to sort through this year in Congress with us is a reporter who's been keeping track of the back and forth. Matt Laszlo, welcome to Latino USA.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, the biggest issue that's making headlines right now is the growing numbers of undocumented children who are coming north. What's your take?
People in both parties just really seem blindsided by this. Even Democrats down there who represent border states in Arizona and Texas, there's a lot of feelings of mistrust that DHS had kind of hidden this problem. And then now the numbers that are coming out and the increased funding that's necessary, but then also the quandary of what do you do with these little tykes who are away from their parents really has people frustrated in both parties.
So has it been seen in any way that the Republicans are trying to say the crisis is out of control, President Obama is out of control, his administration is out of control on the one hand, and on the Democrat side, there was this comment by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that basically said they should go back home?
Well, right now, everyone's just generally concerned. I mean, you're hearing from the far right that you need more enforcement. Speaker Boehner set up a special border security group to look into specifically what to do with these kids and the problem. But the problem is you can't stop this with National Guard troops. These are kids. And when these kids come over the border, they're going to run to the Border Patrol agents because they want shelter.
All right, let's turn now to immigration reform. The push for legislation it's created partners that cross party lines. So you have the ACLU on the one hand, the Idaho Dairy Farmers Association on the other, run by conservative Republicans. You've got tech leaders like Mark Zuckerberg. Has there been any push on their part in terms of a last-minute push for immigration reform?
Well, and that's the interesting thing. All these groups saying, hey, do something, act on comprehensive immigration reform. So Republicans are definitely feeling pressure from all these disparate groups. But there was definitely fear put in rank-and-file House Republicans with the loss of Eric Cantor, which was kind of distorted amongst the national media. And the distortion is that he lost because of immigration reform. Not so much. He lost because he was seen as a Washington insider and out of touch.
That is so fascinating, Matt. The push to get that narrative out that Eric Cantor lost because of his small interest in moving immigration reform forward seemed to have taken hold. Where do you think that this plan to create that narrative around Eric Cantor's loss came from?
Well, so the last 2 weeks of his campaign, Politico put out a piece. And on the one hand, Mr. Cantor was getting attacked for, quote unquote, supporting amnesty. He was also getting attacked by immigration advocates for the opposite. And Mr. Cantor was kind of having it both ways. His opponent hit him on it and latched onto that one narrative that he supported, quote unquote, amnesty. And then that just latched into the conscious.
Wow. Fascinating. All right. So he's been replaced now by California's Kevin McCarthy as House Minority Leader. Do you think that Kevin McCarthy might do anything in terms of immigration and action?
His district is about 37% Latino. He's got all these competing interests just right there in his district, but he's promised his caucus to really listen to them and to not go forward with things that the majority of the caucus doesn't want.
So, as a fellow journalist, give me your real sense as to when serious immigration reform might take place.
Well, here's my read on it. I think what we're going to see is after these elections, when there's a lame duck Congress, some form of it will probably come up.
So piecemeal, perhaps, but a larger scale immigration reform?
I have no idea. Here's the thing that Republicans point out. When the Democrats had the House and the 60 votes in the Senate, so a filibuster-proof majority, they didn't touch this. It's cynical, but this is Washington, and neither party, when they've had the votes, has touched this issue.
Well, thank you for that cold glass of water on the face, Matt. We appreciate it.
I'm sorry.
Matt Laszlo is a reporter who's been covering Capitol Hill since 2006 and occasionally contributes to Latino USA. Okay, mis queridos listeners. If any of you have ever had to deal with immigration paperwork for either yourself or a loved one, you already know it is a serious pain in the... So how is an undocumented person with limited English and in some cases limited education supposed to navigate our immigration system. Often, these people are prone to getting swindled by those who pretend to make the process look easy and painless. There's a lot of people out there trying to take advantage and make a quick buck in the process. These people are often called notarios, or notaries. Our producer, Marlon Bishop, has the story.
Angela Fernandez flips through a stack of paperwork.
As you can see, the application is 21 pages long. This is the new one. This is daunting, 21 pages to apply for citizenship.
She's the director of a nonprofit in Washington Heights, New York City. It's called the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights. They help the public solve immigration issues. For every organization like hers that offers free, quality help, says Fernandez, there are many more that prey on immigrants.
We know that well over 50% of the individuals that come through here have had some kind of interaction with an individual who has promised them legal status, but they weren't able to help them with it.
Immigration fraud can take many forms. There are the dramatic stories of big-time scams, immigrants cheated out of tens of thousands of dollars. But often, it's more banal than that. Just immigration work done poorly by people who aren't licensed, often containing mistakes.
If you make a mistake in your taxes, the worst that can happen is that you have to pay a fine. When you make a mistake in any type of immigration application, you can find yourself torn from your family and from your community.
All over immigrant enclaves such as this one, there are signs, banners, and flyers offering help with immigration. They often advertise as a notario público, Spanish for notary public.
In Latin America, a notario público is actually a very high-end attorney.
This is Valeria Trevis. She runs a nonprofit in Queens called NICE, New Immigrant Community Empowerment.
So many Latin American immigrants confuse a public notary for a notario público. And there's notario públicos out there, or public notaries, that take advantage of the fact that there's this confusion around the language and sort of misrepresent themselves.
By law, notarios cannot provide legal advice. But a study by Valeria's nonprofit found that over 20% of the notarios in her area advertise legal services.
We also found that, according to the law, you're supposed to have a sign that says not an attorney. Nobody had the not an attorney sign.
But there are a few things notarios are allowed to do, like help fill out immigration forms.
The provider can actually act as a scribe, like what's your name, last name, address, this, that, right? So literally as a scribe where you're actually transcribing people's answers. It's a very fine line between doing that and actually giving people advice as to how to fill out a form. They cannot choose the form for you. They cannot give you advice.
I visited a notario in Washington Heights named Jay Mercado. He runs a business called New Age Multi-Services.
We work in the community helping individuals try to become citizens and with some of their immigration paperwork at a low cost.
Mercado says it's true that a lot of notarios are scammers. They overcharge for simple services or promise they can get work authorization for people who are not eligible. But he says he's one of the good guys, doing honest work, and that in most cases, the forms are pretty easy to fill out correctly.
And like everything, once you learn the procedure, okay, you know, it's like, you know, changing a car oil. You learn the steps, and it's boom, boom, boom.
But sometimes it's more like boom, boom, oops, we messed up your papers.
So earlier this year, my father decided that he was going to apply for citizenship.
This is Juan Ramirez. His father was referred by a social worker to a storefront church in Upper Manhattan that runs an immigration service on the side.
They took advantage of him. They filled out his paperwork poorly. They charged him $125. There are free services in the city. A lot of the questions were left blanks. A lot of the questions were answered incorrectly. Things that would have been very easy to spot.
Most gravely, Juan's father had some legal problems years ago. But the preparer who submitted his application didn't include mention of it. It put his application in jeopardy.
The notario was very dismissive, saying, oh, you know, this happens. People have things in their past. Don't worry about it. There are no guarantees. My father got a guarantee, and it could have ended badly. My father could be deported. My father could be in removals. My father could have gotten his citizenship. It doesn't matter. They got their 125, and that's the bottom line for them.
Several people I spoke to in Washington Heights told me about the church's reputation for providing sketchy services, so I decided to stop by. Outside, there's an awning decked out with images of American flags and bald eagles. It reads Center for American Citizenship, Another awning advertises, "We attend all types of immigration cases." Inside the cramped basement office, a man with a thick mustache and Hawaiian shirt sits behind a desk. That man is Pastor Bernardo Favre.
Aunque somos una iglesia, pero no recibimos dinero. Entonces le cobramos una pequeña ayuda a la persona, dependiendo de lo que ellos puedan pagar.
He says the church needs money to support itself, so it asks for a little help in return. How much do they charge, I ask?
No hay exactamente una cifra exacta.
There's no exact number, he says. It's by donation. Then, when I started to ask about the legality of what they do, a woman sitting next to Pastor Favre interrupted.
I don't see an ID on you. Can I see your ID?
This is my driver's license.
That's your driver's license. No, but I want an ID about the radio and the company that you're doing this thing on. No, it's okay. I want your ID.
I was asked to stop recording before I could ask further questions. When Juan Ramirez tried to follow up on his father's case, he got a similar response, his questions avoided and phone calls unreturned. Ramirez's father should have been referred to a lawyer. There's no question about that. But despite the evasive behavior, as long as the church filled out his forms without giving any guidance, they may not have done anything against the law. And that's part of the problem, says Valeria Trevis of NICE. She thinks unlicensed people shouldn't be able to do this delicate work. But as long as they can, they will.
We live in a capitalist society, and like people will extract a dollar any way that they can. And this has clearly been identified as something that people want. They really want paper. So you'll find all sorts of providers out there to provide this for people.
Immigrant advocates are split on the issue. Some want to train the notarios to do better. Others want to shut them down completely. Last week, the New York State Assembly passed a bill creating new regulations for notarios, forcing them to provide clear contracts and offer no-questions-asked refunds, for example. The bill also establishes notario fraud as a crime. But Angela Fernandez from the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights says the problem goes deeper than anything the courts can solve.
There are very few resources that can guide people through the process of regularizing their status. And so because we don't have these resources, it's very easy for the storefronts to pop up.
She says funding from the city for organizations like hers has gone down over the years. Most immigrants simply can't afford to go to a lawyer. And there's just not enough free help to go around. So the notarios fill the vacuum. Despite these challenges, immigrants do their best to figure out how to navigate the immigration maze on their own. Back at the waiting room at Fernandez's Washington Heights offices, about a dozen people wait to speak with trained paralegals. Gustavo, who declined to give his last name because of his status, says his grandmother warned him about notarios after she was scammed twice. Take it slow. Talk to different people, he says. And don't rush into anything. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
We all know Cesar Chavez, the Chicano civil rights leader and co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union. Or at least we all should know him by now. He's the deceased, iconic labor leader behind the first grape strikes. But there's a new Cesar Chavez on the scene, and the only thing the two have in common is the name. Cesar Chavez ran as a Democrat for a seat in Arizona's 7th Congressional District, which has a large Latino population. He was vying for Ed Pastor's seat, Arizona's first Latino congressman, who had just announced his retirement. The thing about Chavez is that he ran for this same seat 2 years ago under his real name, Scott Fistler, and as a Republican. We're joined now by Rebecca Sanders, a reporter with the Arizona Republic, where she broke the story about the candidate who changed his name to Cesar Chavez. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
So catch our listeners up on who is the Cesar Chavez that you're writing about.
Well, this was a mystery candidate for many months in a very tight, competitive congressional race in Phoenix. But no one knew who he was until we revealed his full backstory. And he very cleverly went to court last year to change his name from Scott Fistler to Cesar Chavez. And he had run as a Republican in a council race and this same congressional district 2 years before. He's really political. politically savvy in terms of knowing that if he changed his name, it would at least help him more than his previous name did. The trouble is that when it was revealed, it really backfired on him.
How did you come to meet him?
I just decided to drop by his apartment. And there at the apartment complex, his neighbor said, oh, yeah, Scott lives over there. Knocked on his door, met him. And then in the couple of weeks since this first encounter, we've talked at length a number of times.
So, Rebecca, when you did track down Cesar Chavez, you asked him about his political platform.
This was an unknown for me when I started reporting because he didn't have any policy issues on his candidate website. But once I got him in an interview, I asked him specifics, and he gave answers that fell both on the right and left side. He said, you know, on the liberal side, he's in favor of gay marriage, but crucially, he's against a special pathway to citizenship for immigrants currently in the U.S. The fact that he took that position, I think, shows, first of all, his Republican roots, but also his being out of step with this district politically. But he also seems very sincere when he talks about wanting to give voters a different choice and maybe a choice that isn't the kind of career politician that you see in some of the other candidates.
So because of the legacy of Cesar Chavez, one of his family members, Alejandro Chavez, has in fact filed a lawsuit. What is the case?
Alejandro Chavez is the grandson of the civil rights leader. He lives here in Phoenix in this congressional district. And he brought the lawsuit against Cesar Chavez, the candidate, alleging a number of things, saying he didn't have enough valid signatures to be on the ballot, that he purposely and fraudulently was trying to confuse voters with his name change, even that some of his signatures were invalid because they were collected on the wrong size of paper. So this went to court, and the judge ruled against all of these charges, but the judge did rule that too many of the signatures came from people who weren't registered to vote or, you know, otherwise were invalid. And so it looks like Cesar Chavez, the candidate, will not be on the ballot.
And so now what does he do?
It's unclear where he'll go from here, but it seems to me like with his personality and his drive for attention that we'll probably see him again in the near future.
Rebecca Sanders is a congressional reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks a lot.
We did reach out to former candidate Cesar Chavez, but he is currently declining all interviews. On our website, latinousa.org, you can check out some quotes from the candidate, Cesar Chavez, which would probably make the real Cesar Chavez cringe. Coming up on Latino USA, sometimes if you want to win, you gotta bluff.
The cops told Titi she was very lucky and possibly crazy. Pretending saved her neck, but it easily could have gone the other way.
The sabiduría of sangre fuerte. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Soy el camino que no puede repetirlo. Soy ese tatuaje permanente en tu destino. Tropiezas una y otra vez conmigo. Te da miedo mirarme.
Soy otro mensajero, uno más de todos ellos. Los árboles y las flores, pajaritos y pichones, piénsalo bien, hay algo que entender desde adentro.
La distorsión es perfecta, madurando la paciencia, yo decido cómo elaborar.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Back in January of this year, we did a story about the alarming number of migrant deaths taking place in the desert plains of Brooks County, Texas, 40 miles north of the Mexican border. Last week, in that same area of Brooks County, Texas, anthropologists from Baylor University found a mass grave of unidentified migrant bodies in a county-owned cemetery near the small town of Falfurrias, Texas. Bodies were exhumed from 52 plots, but the actual number of bodies is unknown, as the remains themselves were found in disarray. There were 3 bodies buried in one body bag, 5 buried in another, individual bones like skulls buried without remaining body parts. It is a gruesome scene, and one that leaves a lot of questions unanswered. So to help us make sense of this story, we have with us Monica Ortiz Uribe. She's a reporter with KJZZ and the Fronteras Network. Welcome to Latino USA, Monica.
Thank you, Maria.
Take us to how this story actually breaks.
Well, so there has been an influx, an inundation of immigrants at the South Texas border, as we've heard reported for the last year, actually. And so these migrants, as they're coming further north, they try to skirt a Border Patrol checkpoint that is 70 miles north of the Texas border. These checkpoints are all across the border. And so to try and skirt this Border Patrol checkpoint, the migrants are crossing through this harsh ranch land. Much of it is privately owned, where it's hot, the conditions are very harsh, there's little shade, little water, and some of them die in this very last leg of their journey. And so it falls on the county, it's called Brooks County, to deal with the deaths and to bury the migrants.
So it's Brooks County's responsibility to deal with the deaths. We get that. But this story is about mass graves, unidentified, being found in a cemetery that a funeral home uses. How are these bodies even uncovered? Who was going into the cemetery to say, we're going to exhume bodies?
So there are 2 universities in Texas where their anthropology departments have volunteered students and experts to go in and exhume the bodies and try to identify them. So the bodies that end up buried in the cemetery in Brooks County are the bodies of unidentified migrants. And so they're buried there, and these anthropology experts come and exhume them and use DNA testing. They have a database that they've collected with families in Latin America. And they try to make matches and identify the migrants and send them back home. So these are basically the remains of those who nobody knows who they are.
But something strange happens here, because they go to exhume these bodies, and then all of a sudden they're just finding more and more and more unidentified bodies?
Right. So what they found was the bodies were not buried as you would traditionally expect. There was more than one body found in a single body bag. There were multiple bodies found in one grave site. So basically what the anthropology group is saying is that these bodies were buried improperly and carelessly.
So is there an element where there is a criminal element that is basically murdering people and just burying them in this cemetery? Or is it that the funeral home is trying to hide bodies as well?
Well, that's still a question as to why were these bodies buried in the way that they were and how. As far as the criminal element, there has not been any kind of charges on the funeral home or to anyone. The anthropology team that exhumed these bodies were simply reporting their discovery. And when we talk about mass graves, in the last few years, we've come to think of drug cartels terrorizing migrants on Mexican soil. These graves are different. And the likely story of these migrants is that they crossed into the U.S. illegally and died on this last leg of the journey.
This is very unsettling. What is the vibe now in this area?
Well, as you can imagine, people are frustrated. People are overwhelmed. Certainly the authorities and the people who live there. I was told when I visited last August that sometimes these migrants show up at strangers' front steps looking for water and looking for food in distress. And so no one really knows what to do. They're trying to do their best. They have a limited budget at the county. So it's not, as you can imagine, it's not an easy thing. And it kind of took the county by surprise, I think.
What about the funeral home? Is there a sense that the funeral home is responsible, that they may have buried these bodies and just buried them incorrectly, or that they did nothing wrong?
Well, the funeral home has told other media outlets, as I've been reading the reports, that, you know, they work with the utmost dignity with any of their clients, whether it be a family or the county. And again, it's too early to tell how these improper burials happened. It seems that the anthropology team has just reported their findings, and there are still a lot of unanswered questions.
For all of your reporting on this, Monica, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Monica Ortiz Uribe is a reporter with KJZZ in Phoenix and the Fronteras Network, and a contributor to Latino USA. Sometimes the question of whether you're being true to yourself isn't quite so cut and dry. Gina Chavez is an Austin-based singer-songwriter whose new album, Uprooted, was released earlier this year. In the album, she explores her identity as a Mexicana who only came to understand herself as a Latina later in life. Here's Gina Chavez in her own words about the challenges of being authentic.
This is called a charango, and I like to say that a ukulele and a mandolin met in Latin America and had a little love child. But that's not the truth. It's basically a 10-stringed ukulele-like instrument, and specific to Indian music. My music in general is kind of a journey through Latin America. You know, born and raised in Austin, I'm half Mexican and half Swiss German, but I'm a third generation estadounidense, so from the United States, and a third generation. So I didn't really grow up with much of my Latin heritage. And it was when I went to Argentina and heard this music called a chacarera, and it's a 6-count, just really intriguing kind of rhythm. But I'm in this like super crowded restaurant called La Peña in Buenos Aires. You know, it's really loud, climbing over tables and, you know, chairs to try and find a place to sit and all that kind of stuff. And this band ends up getting on stage and they start playing this music and everybody stopped what they were doing and they just start going clap, 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 along with this particular rhythm. And I was just like, oh my God, what was that? And that kind of started me on a journey to kind of discover my Latin roots through music. The song Maíz is actually written in a chacarera. It's a hopeful song, even though it's kind of a lament. There's a line that says, raíz, dulce raíz. So root, my sweet roots. Arrancado. Sigues vivo en mis venas y mi cantar. Sigues vivo en mis venas y mi cantar. And that's kind of where I bring it back to say, you know, even myself, who's been so far removed from the struggle and the joys and, you know, the beautiful things about Latin culture, but also the struggles and the hurts. Even though I've been so far removed, I've been uprooted from that part of my existence. There's something within me that lives on. You know, and then one of the other lines in Bridge is actually kind of based on a saying that people think from Mexico, but it says, no cruzamos la frontera, fue la frontera que nos cruzó. Hacia los
which is basically like, we didn't cross the border crossed us. And I guess for me that kind of, it represents, you know, it's lines in the sand. And that's, those lines have such impact on people. The name of the album is Uprooted. I feel very planted and at the same time flailing in the air, and I don't know where I, you know, I don't know like where I belong. Kind of accepting who you are, you know, maybe accepting myself as a Latina, even though I look like a gringa or something like that. So. I very much accept myself as a Latina, and I feel very proud to call myself a Latina. And at the same time, I think in the back of my mind, there's always this understanding that I have not necessarily lived the experiences of many Latinos and the struggles of what it really means to be a Latino or what it means to be maybe a dark-skinned Latino.
There are times when pretending can actually save your life. Maria Gonzalez was kidnapped in Caracas, Venezuela, 12 years ago. She was the target of un secuestro express, an express kidnapping, where victims are held just enough time for kidnappers to get a quick ransom. Maria and Ana tell us their story about pretending.
When my sister was kidnapped, the crime rate wasn't as bad as it is now. It was still a dangerous city, but I think what happened to her was, you know, a rare thing to happen back then. And she was actually kidnapped with another friend of hers. They were going to dentistry school.
Estábamos en el carro de una amiga de la universidad.
We were in a car that belonged to a friend of ours who went to college with us, so it was two friends and me. One of them parked the car in an area that was relatively dangerous. It wasn't super dangerous, but it wasn't the safest area either.
What the kidnappers wanted back then, 12, 13 years ago, was cell phones, jewelry, and they wanted to take them to the ATM and get money that way.
Y un señor se acercó con una pistola y nos dijo que no hiciéramos nada porque había un carro atrás.
And this man approached us with a handgun and he told us, don't do anything. There's a car behind you that's following you. He told us if we did anything, he was going to kill us. So he got inside of the car and he started driving. And in fact, when I turned around, I did see there was another car following us. He asked us where the owner of the vehicle lived because it was a BMW and he thought she had money.
My sister convinced them that they were students, which, you know, they were wearing the scrubs, so, and they were kidnapped close to the university. But that they were students and they were from out of town and that they came from a really poor part of the country and that they didn't have bank accounts here. And she hid her cell phone in, like, her underwear.
Y bueno, yo casualmente les inventé una historia de que no.
I came up with a story, and I told him that we weren't from Caracas, that we were from another part of the country, that I didn't know the city very well, and that I didn't know how to get to my friend's house. He told me, shut up, don't look at me. He drove us around for 20 minutes.
The other thing they wanted to do was take them back to their home and steal. They do that, too. It's a modus operandi. That's actually pretty common. They just take you back to your home and steal anything that's there to steal. But my sister told them that they were from out of town and that they just rented a room somewhere in like a poor neighborhood.
Hasta que nos dejó en una urbanización bastante sola de Caracas. Era de noche, casi no había luz.
Then he took us to a neighborhood in Caracas that was very desolate and it was nighttime. There was almost no light and he told us to get out of the car. And I thought they were going to hit us and rape us and even kill us. But thank God none of that happened. They just took everything we had on. They took it with them.
So it worked.
And
when they left, we started walking around and knocking on doors. But nobody wanted to open the door for us because of the danger. But finally, this elderly couple, who were very sweet, they opened their door.
Maria and her sister Ana told their story to Martha Dalton of WABE in Atlanta. Their names have been changed for their safety. Well, my dear listeners, we've devoted our show today to pretending. And sometimes, if you're very lucky, a bluff can pay off.
Today, our senior editor, Lita Hartman, brings us a bit of sabiduría about bluffing with a little help from what she calls sangre fuerte.
When my aunt was a young girl growing up in Puerto Rico, she could walk anywhere, anytime, without fear. 80 years later, she lives on a gated street in a nice middle-class neighborhood in San Juan. But almost no place on the island is really safe anymore. So maybe it was bound to happen. Last Christmas, my titi was woken in the wee hours by noises coming from the ground floor of her house. Home invaders. Her bedroom door was locked. She could have stayed behind it. But no. She got out of bed, opened the door wide, and called out fiercely, "Who are you? What do you want?" Titi is a slight woman, barely over 5 feet tall and barely over 100 pounds. She's going blind in one eye. She has osteoporosis, diabetes, and a pacemaker. She also has sangre fuerte, strong blood, as my grandmother used to say. "Felan," Titi hollered back into the bedroom, "get the gun." Felan was my uncle. He's been dead 8 years. But the thieves, a couple of teenage punks, didn't know that. They turned and ran out of the house. The cops told Titi she was very lucky and possibly crazy. Pretending saved her neck, but it easily could have gone the other way. Titi swears the spirit of Felan was protecting her when she stood there in her nightgown and bare feet, hurling lies into the darkness. I swear that her spirit and the spirit of my grandmother protect me through all of life's uncertainties. Sangre fuerte, when you distill it down, is made of love. There's nothing more powerful than that, and nothing more real.
Thanks for that story, Lita. And we're keeping a velita, a little candle lit for you, Lita, as you recover from surgery. Keep that sangre fuerte flowing. And now this note. We've devoted this week's show to pretending, to be or not to be who we really are. So in honor of pride, we want to give a proud salute to lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, and transgender people everywhere, and for the voiceless LGBTQ people behind bars and in detention. Here at Latino USA, we'll keep reporting your untold stories. So, Feliz Pride, everybody. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Katie Davis, Mitra Caboli, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, and Camilo Vargas. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sara Rocha, Brenda Rodriguez, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima, queridos.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Sometimes it's more like boom, 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 oops.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.